Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Midday. Dan Roderick's with you again. Thanks for making Midday part of your day. Governor Martin O'Malley recently signed into law the Fairness for All Marylanders Act. The legislation updates the state's existing civil rights law to include protections on the basis of gender identity. Several places in Maryland already have provided such protections, including Baltimore City, Baltimore County, Howard County, Montgomery County, the city of Hyattsville. According to polls, more than 70% of Marylanders approved of the statewide legislation, and it marked a major victory for transgender advocates. Still, despite its passage, advocates say transgender people are marginalized by society, and they continue to face discrimination on a day-to-day basis. According to statistics, 70% of transgender Marylanders have experienced harassment or mistreatment on the job because of gender identity. And more than 50% reported having been verbally harassed or mistreated in a place of public accommodation. Transgender people overall are significantly more likely to be impoverished, unemployed, and suicidal than other Americans. And there has been consistent conservative backlash to broad-based protections for transgender people. State Delegate Neil Parrott of Washington County recently tried to repeal the new state law through an online petition drive. Neil Parrott had labeled the law the bathroom bill and had argued that it would endanger women and girls by sexual predators in bathrooms. However, over the weekend, we learned that he failed to get the required number of signatures to move his petition forward. With Neil Parrott's defeat of that effort, we're left to wonder, have we reached a tipping point toward more broad-based acceptance of transgender citizens in Maryland and across the country? The cover story of the June 9th edition of Time magazine asserts that awareness of transgender rights is at an all-time high, buoyed by the same-sex marriage movement, and more discussion generally of transgender people. The transgender actress Laverne Cox from the hit Netflix show Orange is the New Black is on the cover of that Time magazine. Here in Maryland, we have a transgender woman, Dana Beyer, running for state senate. And a transgendered Baltimore City high school student was recently named a prom queen. Today on our show, we're going to be discussing the Fairness for All Marylanders Act so that you understand it. And we'll look at the transgender awareness movement and transgender equality as the next frontier in civil rights. Joining us for the discussion is transgender rights advocate Jennifer Shetty. Jennifer Shetty is a member of several groups that advocate for civil rights of non-gender conforming communities. And she was instrumental in helping get Maryland's new state law passed this year. So we'll get a chance to talk to her about it. And we welcome Jennifer Shetty to the show. Hi, Jenna.
Hi, Dan. Thank you.
And also joining us today is gender studies expert Sarah Raley, an associate professor of sociology at McDaniel College out in Westminster. Sarah, it's nice to have you with us as well.
Thanks, Dan.
Jenna, let's go over the law first of all, get that out of the way so people understand it. It came through the legislature this year. What new protections are there in place? Does that law carry?
Well, Dan, thank you for raising the fact that in your introduction that the Fairness for All Marylanders Act is actually just updates the existing current civil rights law for Maryland. Title 20 of the Human Rights Code for the Annotated Code for Maryland provides protections on many different protected classes. These are classifications or characteristics we believe that people shouldn't be discriminated against, such as race, religion, even age, or what the Fairness for All Marylanders Act does is simply updates that to include gender identity. So nothing really new happens other than we include an additional protected class. So the areas of protection of that are in areas of employment, areas of housing, areas of public accommodations, and also with application for credit. The definition of gender identity, I think, is one of the things that has been concerned with, and we actually received that definition from a suggestion or was inputted by a Republican senator in the Senate during that process. And so as the bill went through, what we have is that gender identity relating to the individual's gender identity regardless of their sex at birth. And that requires it to understand what gender identity means. And every human being has a gender identity. For some of it matches our biological sex, and for some of us, it doesn't. In the cases where it doesn't, that's where those levels of discrimination that you read off exist. People who exist outside the binary understanding of what gender is are the ones that are most marginalized and those that get discriminated against. And so this law actually protects people based upon their gender identity. You don't need to be transgender to be protected by it.
What I found interesting in the Time magazine cover story was this distinction between sex and gender, especially when it comes to gender identity. Your sex is one thing, it's biological, your gender another. Sarah?
Yes, your gender is something that you show, you do. I always tell my students, and they're surprised to hear that gender is an ongoing thing that you create and recreate throughout your whole life based on the cultural standards. So, for example, doing femininity in 2014 in the United States is different from doing femininity in, say, Scotland or in Latin America. The standards for what makes somebody feminine or behave feminine or speak feminine or look feminine are radically different. And even femininity in 2014 in the United States versus looking even further to our founding fathers, those men were wearing wigs and makeup and flirty, flowery shirts with heels and showed their shins to as a kind of sexual attraction. You know, to make a leg was considered something very sexy that men did, not women. So these things are culturally dependent, the way in which we express and identify as being a man or a woman or masculine or feminine.
It's been interesting the last few days in preparation for this show and our discussion at this hour. First, we had the movement last week of the petition drive to overturn, actually repeal the law that you're just describing, Jenna. As I said in the introduction here, Delegate Parrott, who's been known to successfully carry out these petition drives to get laws on referendum, on ballots, didn't succeed this time. So there was that. And then Time magazine arrives at the House, and there's the cover story on the transgender tipping point, asking the question, are we there now? It's an interesting culmination of things here in this week. So first of all, you must be satisfied that the petition drive didn't succeed.
Many in the community were very relieved with that.
Yeah. What were you worried about it? So we ought to talk about that, because that gets us right to what the attitudes are of Marylanders out there. Were you worried about that petition drive?
Well, we were vigilant. To be worried about that, to the extent that we have an obligation to the community to protect, to make sure that the fairness or truth was spoken to lies. And so we weren't going to sit back and just wait for something to happen. And so it was beholden upon us to let people understand what this is about. It serves two purposes in doing that. One is it engenders people to understand what transgender means, to foster a better understanding within that, but also to let them know what the bill does and what it doesn't do. We were concerned only in the sense that he had been successful in the past based upon that online component to gather a large number of signatures. We were fairly confident, though, that based upon some of those numbers that Goucher poll recently and other previous polls about that over the last several years, that people overwhelmingly understand that discrimination against transgender Marylanders is not accepted. The concern really comes in when the storyline here of what's going on gets distorted through misinformation and lies.
Well, they called it the bathroom bill.
Yeah.
Suggesting that, transgender people are sexual predators. Let's say that's what they said. That's what the opposition said about it.
Even if they said that, we're not trying to say that transgender people specifically, but this could open the door up.
Right.
The challenge to them has always been, well, then prove this, in that almost 50% of the country currently has a law protecting someone against gender identity discrimination. That's either through a state level or a municipal level. And so these laws have been on the books since Minnesota first passed a law back in 1975. But on a statewide level, we've been seeing these since at least 1993. And so we've got clearly 20 years worth of experience, 20 years worth of people having an opportunity to do the sort of things that we do. And the only real bathroom issues we run into are bathrooms in a Minnesota airport with Republican senators or congressmen. So the issue really isn't the trans community. And if what they say is true, we would see clear-cut examples happening almost every day.
We have some polling data. You just referred to it there. So it is a legitimate question to ask. Are we getting to a tipping point here because of the factors I mentioned, the same-sex marriage movement, the LGBT community just being more out front, more generally accepted? We know there's still a lot of marginalization, obviously. And yet, you know, here we are. This is kind of a new frontier. People are talking more about it. We're talking about it on the show today. We hear more general talk about it, and there it is on the cover of Time magazine. And it's hard to measure how public attitude is changing, but I would think the defeat of that petition suggests that, yeah, maybe it is.
Absolutely.
Even among conservatives.
Absolutely. And there is some data on acceptance and kind of tolerance that you can track over the years, the General Social Survey. There's surveys that analyze these things. And we do see changes, every year, actually. There's more acceptance to varying expressions of gender identity and gender expression. So this is something we're also seeing in pop culture as well. So beyond the academic, Arnolds of statistics and surveys, we also see all these representations of people in television shows and movies. There's a lot more diversity there. So it's exciting. And I think we are reaching a tipping point. And it's also important to keep in mind that sometimes the loudest voices of opposition, they get the loudest at these tipping points because they're feeling threatened. So, you don't always look at the challenges as setbacks. Sometimes it's evidence that change is afoot. So
this is Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Our phone number, if you'd like to join our conversation this hour, if you have a comment or question for our guests, please join in, 410-662-8780. Interested in your reaction to the Time magazine cover story, if you had a chance to read it. It arrived over the weekend in most households, the June 9th edition, 410-662-8780. I'd like to get your reaction to it, Jenna Fischetti. I'll start with you.
I absolutely believe it's a tipping point, and I agree with Dr. Raley that voices that scream the loudest at these moments, it shows that you're making a difference. And it gives a great opportunity to start talking about the real lived experiences of transgender people. I think that we reached the tipping point, and we really started to come to that tipping point with Chaz Bono, with Dancing with the Stars. That really brought the issue into the forefront. Lana Wachowski with the Matrix series, director coming out as transgender. So a lot of people of note and of higher profile coming out. I think the issue of time is one of those things that I think they're responding to a moment that's already existing. In itself isn't necessarily the tipping point, but I believe that they are actually speaking to one that's been happening for about a year.
What did you think of the article itself?
Well, the article itself was unavailable to me until just recently because it's a subscription base and it wasn't out. But what I did enjoy, at least about the article and that information that's on the line, is I think it really spoke to some of the real lived experiences that transgender people face. And I think it attempted to understand transgender people and that we're not just like everyone else. We are absolutely different, but difference okay.
There's Laverne Cox, a star of Orange is the New Black on the cover, and Sarah Raley, a college professor, profiled inside. Paisley Curra, C-U-R-R-A-H, decided to transition after he had already had tenure as a political science professor at Brooklyn College, the City University of New York. Quote, even in that situation, I was nervous, he says. He was surprised by how smoothly it went, though he believes trans men generally face fewer challenges than trans women. Quote, the culture tends to assign more authority and gravitas to men, Curra said to Time magazine, noting that he doesn't get as many late papers now as when he appeared female. It makes me think a lot about the pervasiveness of sexism. It's interesting, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. And I think there's a lot of sexism and homophobia and all kinds of isms that are wrapped up in the transgender movement, just like any other movement. And sexism is a huge part of our culture. So there's a lot of vignettes that you'll hear from people who transitioned that are trans men saying, wow, it was a little bit easier once I transitioned, actually. And they note kind of these differences that they experienced as both men and women in their lifetimes, which are illuminating. But again, those don't represent the experiences of all trans individuals, so we should be careful about that. And you can't make generalizations about all men and women either based on those very specific lived experiences. But they're insightful.
What do you think of the Time cover? The Time piece, the Time cover, is the movement helped by this photograph of Laverne Cox?
Absolutely. I think it's a wonderful sign of the progress that we're making in our culture with acceptance and understanding of all different types of people. I mean, the one kind of nitpicky criticism I have of the article is that, you know, again, when anyone from a disadvantaged group that's misunderstood or oppressed becomes a figure, a public figure, a celebrity, there tends to be this focus on that characteristic which makes them oppressed or disadvantaged rather than just looking at them as a human being. So, and there's a lot in that story and that article about, you know, what is your experience as a trans woman or as a trans actress? And that's great. And we need that. But I hope that we reach a point when we can chronicle people and their, you know, their characteristics that make them disadvantaged or oppressed in some way are less interesting and more interesting is their experience as a human being.
Sarah Raley visiting us from McDaniel College today, where she's a sociology professor specializing in gender identity. Fairness for All Marylanders Act, we've talked about that. One of its chief advocates, Jenna Fischetti, in the studio with us. We're going to take our first break here on Midday. When we come back, more conversation about this, and we welcome calls from our listeners, 410-662-8780. Did you see that referendum the petition offered in a supermarket, or did you go online and sign it? Are you disappointed it didn't go through? Or do you think, hey, this is a new time, a new frontier, we're moving on from this and generally accepting people, all kinds of people? 410-662-8780. Short break, we'll be right back. And welcome back. Dan Rodrigues here with Jenna Fischetti, transgender rights advocate, and McDaniel College gender studies professor Sarah Raley. Jenna and Sarah, I want to thank Sarah for alerting me to a video that I'm just catching up on the last couple of days. This is an amazing video that I've tweeted out, and you can find it on the Dan Rodrigues Facebook page, a link to it. It's about a 7-year-old child named Rylan Whittington and, let's see, his parents. But it's about the parents realizing that this child is in the midst of a gender identity conflict, and they're dealing with it. It's a kind of an amazing video. I don't know if you get a chance to see it. I understand it's gone viral. It's kind of all over the place now. Did you get a chance to see it,
yes,
Jenna?
Yes, I did.
So, can you describe it for our listeners better than I just did?
Well, I think just at the core of it is really a set of parents who have totally understood that their child is suffering from what is a external conflict, not necessarily an internal conflict. And you have parents who absolutely love their children and want to do the best for them. And I think that's the most significant thing when we talk about acceptance is that parents before or 30 years ago, parents didn't know how to address this issue. Today, because of this tipping point, because of the awareness, because of the work of a lot of tireless advocates over the last 30 plus years, we have a better understanding of this.
And so if you're a parent of a child who is 6 or 7, born a girl, right, who's identifying as a boy constantly, right, mm-hmm. not just a phase, as some people call it, a tomboy phase, but it's gone on for several years and starts very young, in this case, even at the age of 1, right? That's what you're talking about.
Yeah. And for most transgender people, that feeling of cross-gender identification starts very early in. What we start to learn is that when we exhibit those behaviors in an early age, we get pushback, we get conflict, we get beaten down both physically sometimes and emotionally. And so what we learn is that we stop engaging in certain behavior and actions that express a sense of gender which is incongruent to what people have assigned upon us. And so sex birth is actually assigned at birth. Based on a crude estimation of what gender or what sex that individual is, mm-hmm. based on external genitalia of an infant, there's no other factors that are determined within that. And so, as you spoke...
So gender is cultural,
well,
right?
Yes.
Gender is not biological. We sort of went over that earlier,
it's
right?
Gender is more what's between your ears, how your brain works, mm-hmm. and how the brain's programmed versus necessarily what the physical aspect, what your physicality is.
Right. What was your reaction to the video?
Oh,
I found it kind of amazing. I mean,
I did too, except that I'm seeing those examples in parents all over the place. There's an incredible woman who works with PFLAG in Columbia, Catherine Hyde, who is just an amazing of an advocate. And so when I saw that, my first reaction was thinking about her child, who is a transgender woman, and Catherine, and the experience that she went through in dealing with her daughter, who was being harassed at a school gathering with the Howard County Police Department, and she was somewhat being mocked for who she was. And that led Catherine on a quest to actually change some things. And she was a very lead and a leading edge of the movement to actually change the laws in Howard County to add for non-discrimination protections. So I've been seeing that all over the place. Some incredible, amazing parents who have been.
So parents are what, more informed? Sarah, go to you on this. Parents are more informed. They're thinking more about this. They're consulting therapists.
Well, I think our culture as a whole is becoming more informed, and so therefore parents are going to be more informed. But I think even still, most parents at the outset aren't that informed, but they understand to seek out the information better at this day and age versus previous generations. And for example, there's more resources out there for them to turn to because more people have spoken out about being a parent of somebody who's transgender or being transgender themselves or being a friend of somebody who's transgender. There's a whole organization called PFLAG, which is Parents and Friends.
That's the one Jenna just referred to?
So,
Parents and Friends, what is it called?
Well, Parents and Friends of Lesbians and Gays.
Okay, thanks.
It means the
But
the
it
broader.
Also extends beyond just lesbians and gays. It's a, mm-hmm. it's a pretty expansive organization.
Have you ever seen a video like this before?
No, I have not.
Okay, so this is something new as well. Which gets me to your story, Jenna. I wanted to hear from you a little bit for our listeners' sake about what your transition was like, when it started. How old are you today?
Right. Well, so I'm 49 years
49
old. 49 to you. One of the things that, from my experience growing up, is that I also know that at a very early age that who I am and placing that, my subjective experience with my body, myself, my sense of who I am, when contrasted to the social groupings we have of boys and girls or men and women, it didn't fit within that. And I didn't identify with the things that the other boys that I was growing up with did. Hmm. So I did know that was at an early age there was something different. I couldn't put my finger on it. Well before the years of the internet, their really only public resource was a library. And so after school, I would go to the library waiting for the parents to pick you up in the carpool. And I would look for that book that would describe what it was I was feeling that would tell me why it is I felt the way that I did. But I never did find that.
Did you share those feelings with your parents or anyone?
Well, I didn't at the time. And part of the reason was is that when I grew up, Renee Richards had just come out and become popular. Her notoriety as being a trans woman was prevalent. And I remember the reaction of my family to the story and in conversations and being driven to school with my brothers. And that the way that they reacted to that told me that maybe this isn't quite the best place for me to come out with this. Mm-hmm. And so I took that and I held it down deep and I just kept telling myself, well, that's not really me. That's not really me.
And how old would you have been at that time?
That would have been 13, 14.
Teens, yeah, early teens.
Teens. Okay. Yeah. At a point when you're already uncomfortable with yourself, any teenager is. You know, child development, you had a wonderful guest on last week talking about child development, the neuropsychologist from UCLA, and that we're all learning at the early ages, but at your teenage ages when you're learning how to fit in to assimilate within society. And so it's a very awkward period where you're trying to learn how to fit in society and you're just not getting into the right slot that they want to put you in.
That program was about adolescence and what goes on in the teenage brain. And when you add this layer to it, it makes it even more complex and challenging.
Right. And so there's a lot of socialization that does not happen for transgender people as a result of that. I do remember, though, of course, that at that age, what was popular was shock therapy treatment. And I've met many people in the trans community who have shared, who may be of a bit of older age than I am, who've shared that when they were treated for this condition, shock therapy was one of the things they figured they could shock that out. Or we've heard of reversion therapy where we could pray the gay away. And people think that it's something that can just go away, but it's really something that's innately hardwired into the brain. And so it's not something that you can just change.
So what did you do, Jenna?
Well, I did what anyone would do. I drowned myself in drugs and alcohol for many years. In my teenage years, I started to detach from society and friends and people and isolate. That didn't work too well.
I meant to ask you, were you bullied? As a kid?
Well, yeah. So growing up as a kid, there were certain terminologies that boys would use with other boys, and the sissy, the F word, and things of that nature. And even the word gay, that was a very strong derogatory. Queer was another one at the time. And so while you get those things, you know, you go through that and you think, well, that's just life. But when you talk to other people who've had different experiences, it's not quite the same. So harassment, bullying, and the things that you learn are you just keep it kind of quiet. My parents were also, I was raised Catholic. I was an altar server. I was even a Boy Scout. And one of the things that I learned was that as my parents grew in their faith, they became born-again Christians. And in that dynamic, that understanding of their God was so different than what my understanding was God was. And I felt that if God did this to me, God must not love me. And so I clearly walked away from communities of faith and even just other support.
How was your relationship with your parents? It sounds like they became
very distant,
increasingly
to me.
Devout. Right?
They became more devout, and I became more distant to them. Yeah. So as a kid, the thing that I found was I can get on a bike and just ride away all day long and just detach from that, come home by the end of the night, and things would be okay. Now, my parents absolutely loved me. And my parents, later when I came out to them, told me that, well, at 14, we thought you were gay, because their understanding of the word gay meant those who were lesbian, those who are gay, and what was considered at the time gay transvestites. That was just the terminology they had. All they had for signifiers to represent what someone was experiencing were very limited terms.
Right. I remember using the term transvestite.
Right.
And actually being called out on it once. I used it in the newspaper, and the person I used, I had described a person as a transvestite, and that person came after me at the Baltimore Sun and wanted to clear that up.
Right.
Yeah, I remember.
What that word does, it assigns an individual's gender to that. So to be a transvestite, you must have a gender or dress in a manner that's inconsistent to your gender.
Right.
And so, and then that word is describing, well, that's a person who's based upon their sex. And so when you say transvestite, it's because you're making an assumption about what their sex is. And so there's a conflation of sex and gender in that and a misunderstanding with that. And that's why people don't use that terminology today the way that they did. And we have a broader and a much richer lexicon to describe some experiences of people. So for me, I hid that for quite some time. In fact, I was 34 years old before I ever told another human being. And it was a girlfriend I had at the time. And I was able and managed, she made me feel comfortable in a dynamic, and I could open up about being transgender. And ever since then, my process of what I call a gender confirmation, some people call transition, is not about becoming someone else. And I don't think that's the experience in relating to other people in my 5+ years as a moderator of a peer support group for transgender individuals. We don't become other people. It's a reclamation. It's a confirmation. We're actually discarding some of the things that we have added to ourselves to hide behind or as defensive shields. And we're just discarding that and actually becoming very authentic.
That's 20 years.
That's a long time.
That was a long time. 20 years, did you work? Were you employed? Did you live alone?
I was married. Three kids, the mortgages, all the trappings.
Married and
had
three children.
And I still have those wonderful three children who are all teachers. So I'm very proud of them in that respect. And I today have support from my former spouse and my former in-laws. And I still have some growing respect and understanding from my family. It's a matter of still wrapping their heads around it. But what I did during that time period is I worked. I was in the car business for almost 20 years, until July of 2004, when on one Saturday night I was actually out dancing with a friend at a club, being my authentic self. And afterwards, we went to a little diner in Canton called the Sip and Bite, not to give a plug for them, but it's a Greasy Spoon
one
where a lot
of
people go.
Places,
right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And a coworker was sitting at the counter, and he looked up from the mirror that's in front of him, and he saw me, and I saw him. And that look in his eye told me he knew he'd spotted me. And I was dressed in a manner quite inconsistent with the way that I was when I worked at this dealership. And that evening, which was a Saturday night, through Sunday morning, the dealership was closed Sunday, but he was texting and contacting other coworkers. When I got into work on Monday, it was like that scene from a movie where everyone crisscrosses through and they're staring at you and it's in slow motion. And you could feel the tension was thick. And by Wednesday morning, I was pulled out of the manager's meeting when I arrived, and I was let go. I was given reasons for my work was off, and I could back that up with some data. And then I was told it just wasn't going to work out.
You obviously dressed differently at work.
At work, yes. I presented mail.
Yeah.
Right.
Wow.
So part of that.
That's amazing. When you're with family now, how does that go? When you go to a gathering of family, if you go,
bearing in mind my detachment from my family growing up is we do have distant lives in some respects. We're not quite as close as some of the other families that you hear about, and that's probably more consistent today for families than before. So my relationship is very similar, and I think it's grown a little deeper because of that.
From that first act of discrimination, you would call it today, right? Obviously, you called it that day. Have there been others in your life since then?
Yeah, actually, as a result, it's very difficult to find employment because identity of documentation always isn't always consistent. The process is kind of cumbersome for individuals to change their ID documentation. Only 21% of all transgender people have all their documents updated. So if I was to go in for a job, most of my employment records was in their name, John, whereas if I apply for a job as Jennifer, which is my legal name, there's a mismatch and there's confusion, and that discloses my transgender status. And so as a result of which it was difficult to find a job, I worked in the retail industry, and what I found was that prior to living full-time and coming to my employer and saying, this is what I'm going through the process-wise, and I'll be living and presenting as Jenna, while they were supportive, from the 9 months I worked with this company prior to, I had been elevated and given promotions as the need came up on three different occasions after the fact, after the transition for almost 2.5 years later. Every single position I applied for, I was never given an opportunity. I had gone from that job within 3 years of being there, I'd only received a dollar raise over the total period of time. And so there was discrimination based upon my gender nonconformity. Existed even at that level, even though they allowed me to present as myself.
And that made you an advocate.
Well, that
these experiences,
those
I'm
experiences,
assuming
those experiences, along with sharing real lived experiences as a moderator at the support group. But what really brought me into the advocacy world was 3 years ago when, I think you alluded to it early in the introduction, that there was a legislation that was introduced 3 years ago that excluded provisions for public accommodation. And I had felt that at that time that the decision was made to do so without any buy-in or accountability to the transgender community. And so I had spoken up along with several other advocates in the community about that. And the request was to actually amend the bill to include public accommodations, and that to include the entirety of our community, not to, to water this bill down to include only people who've transitioned, because that's such an exclusive club for those who have the wealth or the access to those sort of things. And so my involvement started with that. I can assure you that the passage of this bill has been a huge team lift, and there are hundreds of advocates who have worked on this since almost 20 years now.
Thank you for sharing that story with us, Jenna. I go to Sarah before this break, and listening to this story, you're hearing this story as I am and our listeners are for the first time. I guess the hope would be today that the teenage John, or who's now 13 or 14, facing the same feelings that Jenna was facing back then, is in a different culture, in a different environment. Maybe we can hope today. I don't know what evidence we have. Teenagers, it's still a pretty brutal world when it comes to what they say to each other. And we hear a lot about bullying, right?
Oh, yeah.
But the hope is that maybe you don't have to wait so long or repress so long.
And that there are other, especially with the internet, there are other resources and places that you can go to kind of recognize you may not be alone in having certain feelings. And also as a parent, you may not be alone in having a child who is trans. And so, for example, there's a book called My Princess Boy that was released several years ago. I think the author may even be a Marylander, but I'm not sure about that. So that's almost a resource that anyone can give to their child to learn about transgender. So regardless of the child's gender identity, this could be a learning tool. So kids are getting that now, and they're getting more sensitive language about gender identity and gender. So you hope that they grow up with more resources and potentially more support from friends, from relatives. There's also been a shift in the way in which we think about transgender issues medically speaking. So for example, the term gender identity disorder, which was very popular for many years and is actually used to help in some ways it's used in a positive sense to allow people to transition medically if they so choose, so they get diagnosed with gender identity disorder. But many people have taken issue with that because it makes it seem like they're disordered, something's wrong with them, when really it's more there's something wrong with the culture that doesn't allow people to express themselves however they wish to or identify.
You're talking about the actual clinical term that was used by American Psychiatric Association in their manual,
exactly,
the DSM, and now it's called gender dysphoria.
Exactly.
It's not gender identity disorder anymore. That implied what you say, that there's something wrong there, even though I help people get the medical treatments that they wanted. This dysphoria refers to just a confusion? What is dysphoria?
Well, I would never...
Discomfort with who you are, with your gender.
Well, I mean, even that's, I think, difficult to say because I meet many trans people who are very comfortable with who they are. It's really more about other people being comfortable. So,
but it's not the word disorder. So they found a different term for
right.
it.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
Sarah, thank you. We're going to take another break here. Sarah Raley from McDaniel College, a sociology professor who specializes in gender studies, and Jenna Fischetti, a transgender rights advocate here in Maryland. 410-662-8780. If you have a comment or question, like to join us in this hour of midday, we'll take a short break. We'll be right back. Before I go on, I think it was interesting to talk a little bit about media coverage of transgender issues. We're talking about the Time magazine cover. This is a pretty interesting little episode that went on when Piers Morgan still had his talk show on CNN. The show was canceled in March. But he was interviewing the transgender author Janet Mock. The interview seemed to be going well, but then it was over. Janet Mock went on Twitter and started criticizing Piers Morgan the way he conducted the interview. So let's just listen to this and talk a little bit about it. Here's Piers Morgan introducing Janet Mock on that show.
Janet Mock has a remarkable life story. Janet was born a boy, and at the age of 18, she took the extraordinary step to become the woman that she is today. But Janet went even further in 2011, revealing her secret to the world in a profile in Marie Claire magazine. Janet's now a fierce advocate for the transgender community and is telling her story in the new memoir, Redefining Realness, My Path to Womanhood, Identity, Love, and so much more. And Janet Mock joins me now exclusively. How are you, Janet?
Very good.
So this is the amazing thing about you. Had I not known anything about your story, I would have had absolutely not a clue that you had ever been a boy, a male.
Okay. It didn't seem to be so bad so far. Sarah, what became problematic about this interview?
Well, even that comment actually is
yeah,
is
that's
a little...
Piers Morgan. Okay, all right, yeah.
But I mean, I think that's the you know, that you used to be. Again, you know, as Jenna was saying earlier, it's not about who you used to be. It's how you who you are, and for many, who you've always been. So
yeah.
Sometimes kind of, and also this idea of like, you're so believable as like a real woman, quote unquote. I mean, those
okay.
kind of comments.
That's the TV guy that
right.
coming across there a little bit. Okay. There's a little bit more to this. Piers Morgan immediately went into the defensive mode after this interview, after these tweets started coming, right?
Right.
Then he invited Janet Mock to come back on his show to explain herself. And here's an excerpt from that second conversation.
Why have I been vilified for being transparently supportive of you? I don't get it.
Maybe you don't get it because you're not a trans woman. Trans women
are... Well, explain
are...
to me. Explain to me what I did wrong. What did I do wrong?
You called, so before commercial break, we had a lovely conversation, and then all of a sudden you said, who was formerly a man. I was a baby. I was assigned male gender because of the appearance of my genitals.
Okay. Let's go on a little bit more with that. I mean, I get what you're saying, that you kind of have to understand that a person who has made this transition was always this person.
Sure,
right?
Right.
Okay.
Well, not and again,
I mean, you get so worried about your words sometimes, about how you phrase things, especially in my business. You become so self-conscious, you never have a conversation.
Sure, right? Of course. Well, and I think maybe that's part of it. Maybe if he had stepped back a little bit and said, hey, what did I say, and tried to understand, what did I...
He did sound defensive.
Rather than saying, like, why have I been vilified? So I think part of it is kind of how you approach and your intentions when you're having these conversations and trying to learn versus being defensive about, you know, I don't want to say the wrong thing, and I'm, you know, I'm sick of this political correctness. You know, I get that from people sometimes. But at the same time, if you kind of approach conversations with an openness and willingness to learn and willingness to maybe say something that's incorrect or problematic, but yet learn from that, then people, I think, will be gentle with you versus if you kind of go on the defensive.
I mean, the problem, I guess part of it is that it's such a small group of people in America who've done this, such as a minority within a minority within a minority, and so few Americans have experience with people who are trans, right, Jenna? Isn't that it? If you have experience with them, then maybe...
I totally concur. I think
you understand it better.
This is a situation where privilege is never a problem for you if you're not suffering from the effects of it. And in this case, there is something called cisgender privilege in relationship to the fact that his lived experiences, Piers Morgan's lived experiences, have not challenged him every step of the way through his life with his authenticity or his identity. He's not being questioned. Whenever he goes to the bank to withdraw money, his documentation doesn't mismatch. So he doesn't have some of those experiences. He doesn't understand the struggles with that. Now, I give him a pass in the first time it happens, in that if he doesn't know, and this becomes an educational moment. I think we as a community need to remember that while it can be inflammatory and it can offend us, it's important that we pivot on that and make it a learning opportunity with that. And a lot of advocates do a lot of work with that.
Well, that's what I did with a person that I called a transvestite right. In a column in the Baltimore Sun years ago. This is 10, 15 years ago now. She came to see me, and we had a conversation, and she explained what she was going through in life. And then I followed up and did a second story, and that wasn't a learning experience
right.
for me. That was probably at least 10 more like 15 years ago.
Everything should be a growth experience with that. And I think for Janet Mock's situation is that the reason she came back on was the Twitter world was a lit because of what had happened. And the big concern was that regardless of his statements, there was a creeper or the crawler at the bottom of the screen, which has born a boy and just flashing that over. And so I think there was more of the graphics related to that added to his language, which could be problematic. And again, first time out, I can give someone a pass who's unfamiliar with that, make it a teaching moment. But if you continue to do that after that fact, then it's on you.
Let's go to the phone lines and take a couple of calls here. 410-662-8780. Jay is calling from Washington, D.C. Jay, thank you for holding. Go right ahead, please.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So part of my job is to listen to CEOs, understand what their issues are. And when I brought up this bill, a lot of it people understood makes sense. I feel I could never experience what these people experience, and I think a lot of it makes sense. However, I think there's a huge law of unintended consequences, and what I'm hearing from the CEOs that I've discussed and talked with is that they've given and they love the opportunity to give people who are, a minority in these type of senses an opportunity. Not everybody does, obviously. Many don't. But the circumstances are, what I heard from the CEOs were the moment they heard that a transgender individual became a protected class, they completely changed their tune and said, I could never take the chance of hiring somebody who would be so potentially lightning strike for the opportunity for causing issues within my company. You know, we obviously live in a litigious society, and we have a lot of people who are willing to take on cases that may be marginal, and they feel that the opportunity to go after for somebody who's a transgender who may feel, because maybe they had to be fired for legitimate reasons, and all of a sudden you look at somebody who becomes a lightning rod for the opportunity of potential discrimination, every single CEO I spoke to said in the past they would hire somebody transgender, they would know what, and they said this off the record because they knew they can't be told. So what I feel is there's a huge law of unintended consequences here, and we have to be, I like a lot of the legislation that goes along with this, but we, you know, unless they plan on reforming legal legislation, which doesn't make it, you know, so you can hire somebody right now on contingency, and just because it doesn't cost you anything, and so all of a sudden the employer is in for hundreds of thousands of dollars, it becomes a situation where these employers don't want to take the chance. I think this has to be rethought.
Well, they want to take the chance, meaning they would discriminate in hiring.
In other words, so, they're going to discriminate because
they're
going to
discriminate because they're afraid of litigation. I understand. Let's hear from Jenna on that, Jay. Thank you.
So, when you're talking about employers, you're saying that you're from the District of Columbia, and bearing in mind, I'm going to assume that you're referring to Maryland employers. Any claim against discrimination in Maryland is going to be handled through the Maryland Commission for Civil Rights. There's no right of private action directly the way that you might have in other states. It's not as if I could just go hire an attorney to take that case. A case of discrimination brought against an employer would actually go through the Commission of Civil Rights. In that case, they would do the investigation whether there would be actually an incident of discrimination. The law is written as such to exclude companies with less than 15 employees. While that CEO that you spoke to may hold that sincere belief, and there may be many that you spoke to that hold that, I think it's important to note that also that many of the top Fortune 500 companies already have transgender inclusive policies or gender identity inclusive policies within their hiring, their promotion, their training processes. So I don't know that those opinions and those experiences that you're referring to are very prevalent within the actual business community.
It just seems to me that you're talking about anybody. I mean, anybody potentially could sue you on the grounds that their dismissal was unfair. They were treated unfairly. It still needs to be proven, right?
Right. This seems like more of an objection to our litigious society and how easy or, you know, depending on your perspective, how easy it is to bring a case against an employer for being hired or fired, excuse me, unfairly or not hired. So that, to me, is a more general complaint about the legal system.
We're down to our last minute or so, but Jahantir, you wanted to say something. Jahantir, go right ahead quickly, please.
Hey, Dan, I don't want to come across as an insensitive person, but I want to assure you that I am absolutely supportive of the cause. But this is just talking back about the Piers Morgan interview.
Yes.
Just as Piers Morgan was sounding defensive, the person who was being interviewed was also sounding very aggressive. And I think that alienated more people from the cause than getting support from the cause. I think the transgender community needs to have an organized, I'm not talking about the legislation part of it. I think that should be enforced and that should be tried to be done in all possible ways. But the PR effort should be a little more diplomatic. Rome wasn't built in a day.
Okay.
We have to remember that.
Jahantir, thank you for a little too much reaction there from Janet Mock.
I concur, because I think that if you're asking for respect from an individual, you need to show respect back. And sometimes you need to make sure that it's not going to take it's going to take more than just a minute to get some understanding growing in that.
If you got an issue with the host, speaking for all the hosts, I would say, you know, don't tweet about us. Tell us point blank you got a problem. Wait for a commercial break and tell us you didn't like what was said. Could you restate that? Let's go over that. Let's have a talk about it. You go off the air and start tweeting about it, it seems to me. Yeah, maybe that's not the way to go about it, but anyway. Anyway, thank you for this conversation, Jenna. It was nice to meet you after all this time, and congratulations on getting the bill passed and for the referendum not coming to fruition, right? The petition drive failing. It was nice to meet you. Thank you very much. And Sarah Raley, nice to have you with us, too, for the first time. Sarah Raley is an associate professor of sociology at McDaniel College, and their area of scholarship is gender studies. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. That's the first hour of Midday, but please stay tuned. We got another hour of the show coming along here after we take a break for lunch. And brunch or lunch? Actually, it's lunch because it's going on 1 o'clock now. Lunch provided on Wednesdays by Breathe Bookstore Cafe. Breathe Bookstore Cafe serves vegetarian, vegan, and gluten-free savory sweets, coffee, tea, juices, and more. Breathe Bookstore Cafe opens 7 days a week, located on the Avenue, 36th Street, in good old Hamden. Please stay tuned for the news, and then it's the second hour of our show.